It's now time for your favorite Sunday evening program with Dr. Renee Boyce. You're listening to, of course, the Better Health Radio Show. Let's say a very good evening to Dr. Boyce. Good evening, Doc.
Hi, good evening, Gretchen. Good evening to all of our listeners. And yes, this is your favorite Sunday evening health program, the Better Health Radio Show, helping you to live your best life. I met a gentleman last night. I did not have the opportunity to catch his name, but he was able to tell me, yes, I listened to the show. I heard the show when we were talking to Dr. Alexis about the blood thing. What was it called again? That's why we were talking to Dr. Alexis about hemophilia. So it's great to know that you are listening, and not only listening, but you are fulfilling the purpose of the show in that you are learning and you're understanding things. So I'm really happy about that. If you want to give us a call in the studio, that's going to be 434-1790, 434-1790. And should you want to send your queries or comments by WhatsApp, that would be 266-4862. Now, this evening, we have a lot of ground to cover. We had our fun last week where we had our quiz. We had a blast. I had a blast. If nobody else had a blast, I did. And we're looking forward to our end of year quiz. And this evening, we have with us, he is a repeat guest. This is Dr. John Barker, obstetrician, gynecologist. And I want to say publicly to you, John, a very big thank you for jumping on board with the Better Health Radio Show. The show would not be what it is without the guests who willingly come on and share their wealth of knowledge. I mean, it wouldn't be what it is without listeners, but certainly those persons who willingly participate, they give up their time and they give up their information. So I want to say thank you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you know who the guest is this evening. This is Dr. Barker, and we are going to be talking all things surgical, both obstetric and gynecological. So let's jump right into it. Before we can cut any patient, one of the things that we must, and hear me there being all bold and saying we. No, sir, not me. Before you and others in your profession can cut any patient, we talk about informed consent. And believe it or not, informed consent is not only for surgeons. I was just joking around. It is a very important part of medical legal issues dealing with law and medicine. So let's talk a little bit briefly, John, about informed consent before we jump into the actual gynecological and obstetric surgeries.
Yes, please. All right, so essentially when you see a patient, examine them and send them for your investigations and you come to a definitive diagnosis and the person needs surgery, you have to make sure that the indication warrants the actual surgery. That is both on the disorder that the patient has and also too on the skill of the particular surgeon. So once the indication is met, then once the person is a candidate for the surgery, then this is when the informed consent comes in. The informed consent is the most important part before you even do anything. So therefore, you have to get the name of the procedure that would be best for the patient. And this would depend on the clinical experience and exactly what procedure you want to do. Once you have that, you have to tell the patient, well, this is what we're going to do. For example, if you're going to do a hysterectomy, you have to have the indication, which is uterine fibroids, etc., or cancer. So that's your indication. The next thing that you have to explain is the actual procedure itself. So for argument's sake, you tell them, well, they will come in as a day case or for 2 or 3 days. This is the procedure that you're going to do. You go through step by step in relation to the actual procedure itself so that the patient has an idea as to what you're going to do. You can either give them a patient information leaflet afterwards or sometimes I will show them like a quick video of the actual surgery itself so that they have an idea as to what's going on. Once that is done, then the next thing is the risk and the benefits. So you have to tell them what's the benefit of doing the surgery, and then you have to tell them the risks. Now, the risks are very important because if you don't explain all of the risks, then if something happens, all the patient basically has to say is that, if I didn't know, if I didn't know, I wouldn't do it. And you got to put your hands up. So you got to go through all the risks. Now you have frequently occurring risks and you have serious risks. Now the frequently occurring risks would be like, say, like if you get like a wound infection, sometimes you can get the wound breaking down. Sometimes you can get bleeding. Sometimes you can get keloids. So these sometimes would be frequently occurring risks. Other things would be serious risks would be if you're doing like internal surgery. So sometimes you have to tell them about, sometimes if you do a hysterectomy, you have a very small chance you can get like a bald injury. Sometimes you can get a bladder injury. Sometimes you can get a ureteric injury, which is true from your kidney to your bladder. And you have to tell them the risk of it. And you have to tell them what procedures you would have to do if you diagnose it. Now, some of the things with surgery is that everything can go well when you're doing it, but then you can get a complication that you would not have seen or know about. For example, sometimes everything goes well. Sometimes you can nick a bubble. Sometimes you can have an iatrogenic injury, like if you're using diathermy. Sometimes the diathermy, which is the buzz to stop the bleeding. Sometimes it can spray, and sometimes it can injure your organs and stuff. But these are stuff that you don't see at the time. Because if you're doing surgery, you actually have, if you recognize the complication in intraoperatively, then it's in your best interest to fix it there and then, right? So once you go through all of these and you show the patient the videos, et cetera, and you give them the leaflets, and then you can consent them because they'll be fully informed of the actual procedure itself. And then just before the surgery, you go through the consent form again. You tell the patients if they got any questions anytime between now and the surgery, feel free to call and ask, because the 5 minutes it can take you to explain it might save you a bunch of trouble later on.
Later on.
Yeah, correct. And then finally, on the day of the surgery, then what we do is a confirmation of consent, which is to go through everything again and ask the patient if they have any other questions and if they're right through everything, etc. So that's fully informed consent, which, and then the consent form would have the name, date of birth, the procedure, the indication for the procedure, and the ones that I would use personally and professionally would have all the different complications, the risks, and the procedures to repair or do whatever you have to do in relation to any complications. So you're fully informed before you actually go into theater. So that's the most important thing before you cut.
Yeah, and you definitely have to make sure that the patient, one, has the ability to consent.
Correct.
And for example, a 91-year-old, let's not say 91, a 72-year-old patient with dementia, advanced dementia, cannot consent to a surgery. So somebody would have to do that on her behalf.
On their behalf, correct. And children as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the other thing is definitely to confirm that the patient has said yes, because the legal battles that you can end up in at the end, wow. And you have to make sure the patient understands. And even let's step outside of surgery just a little bit. A simple thing as explaining the diagnosis to a patient, where you sit down, you go through the diagnosis and so on, and then you ask the patient, please explain to me what I've just said. And in many cases, depending on how you've explained, who's doing the explaining, the patients don't have a clue. So when relatives ask, you went to the doctor, what's your diagnosis? Or when another patient comes into your office, so what did the doctor tell you? I don't know. So you need to
it happens quite often.
So we are going to, and one condition that I can think of where informed consent really is not taken into consideration is medical emergencies, life-threatening emergencies, where the patient's life is on the line and a decision and they're unable to consent, a decision has to be made at that particular point in time. And it's not necessarily only surgery, but other interventions like giving blood or fluids or resuscitation, all of those things sometimes you really can't get consent for. So good, that's enough of the medical legal stuff. And we are into true obstetrics and gynecology. Let's start with gynecology. A simple procedure like the insertion of an intrauterine device.
Yes,
most persons, probably don't have an idea of how that is done. So what we want to do this evening is try to give patients a glimpse into some of the procedures and so they can have an image of what is done.
Okay, so for argument's sake, if you have a lady who wants a, we call it intrauterine device, which should be Myrina, or you can have on the other side, which would be a copper T. Both are contraceptives. The advantage of the Myrina is that it has in a hormone called levonorgestrel. So the advantages would be sometimes it can stop your periods altogether. So we use it for like heavy menstrual bleeding or lining of the womb abnormalities like endometrial hyperplasia. Now, what we usually do is say, we tell the patient, well, it's going to be a short procedure whereby, and everybody's different. So that's the first thing you have to realize, because everybody's pain tolerance is completely different. But the majority of the time, most of it is done under local anesthetic. Sometimes you may get away without giving anesthetic as well. And this would be anesthetic in the actual cervix itself. So we do what we call a cervical block. And before that, we usually would give ibuprofen or paracetamol before. What I would usually then say would that we put a, it'd be a T, so it looks like a small T, and it goes in up to the top of the womb. And everything is done down below via the vagina. And essentially what we do is to, depending on the parity of the lady or how many children they had, would determine how easy the actual procedure would be. If you had children before, then it's a bit quicker, because sometimes we don't have to dilate up the neck of the womb, which is, the womb is like a cylinder. So what we will have to do is to give the local anesthetic and then dilate up the neck of the womb and then put the copper T or the intrauterine device in. Now, once that is done, it has two strings at the end. So what we do then is cut the strings. The reason for the strings is that that's how we get it out. Sometimes the strings get lost inside, so then we have to go looking for
searching
them.
Searching for them.
So this can be done on the local anesthetic, whereby we use a special tube which has like rivets on it to actually, or prongs to actually find the trace to pull them out. Sometimes this doesn't work, so sometimes you might have to put a camera inside, then to have to find the strings and then pull the actual device out. But that is exception rather than the norm. And then the major thing after the procedure is sometimes it can get some cramping. So that's why we give you medication, or we routinely give you medication like paracetamol or ibuprofen before the procedure, so as to decrease the amount of cramps that you get. Okay, and then so sometimes...
Go ahead.
Right, and then the other thing would be infection. Usually the coil is sterile. Well, the coil is sterile, and sometimes it can get an infection after putting it in, but you have to tell the patients that the coil itself doesn't cause the infection. Sometimes it might have what we call a subclinical infection going on, and then when we introduce a foreign body, then that is what flares up everything. Depending on the nature of the infection, if it's mild to moderate, you can leave the coil in, but if it's a severe infection, then you have to take it out to make the patient better. Right. So in terms of the risks of putting in the coil, would be infection, sometimes you can get cramping, sometimes you can get bleeding. And the minor risk is sometimes it can get what you call a perforation, which is a hole in the womb. So as a result, the coil can become embedded, or very rarely the coil can be actually be in your abdominal cavity, which is your belly.
We have a call, and before we jump into how you check for your intrauterine device, we'll take this call. Mm-hmm. Hi, good evening. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Dr. Boyce, good evening to you and your guest.
Hi, good evening.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Barker, I want to take you back to your opening comments, Dr. Barker. You spoke eloquently. You spoke quite eloquently about the consent form. But
yes,
I believe that there's more to that consent form than you explain. Example.
Yes, please.
That consent form is to say, yes, we give you consent to do the operation. But does that consent form also save you or exonerate you from any legal intervention?
Well, no. What it shows is that the correct process was used in terms of consenting the patient for it. Now, once you properly consent, because remember that if you have a case against you, they have to prove that you actually breached.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a breach of care, right? Right. So you have a duty of care, and then you have to breach that care. So in the first instance, what they do is look at the consent, how you were consented, if all the risks were explained, if the risks or the benefits outweigh the risks, or if the risks outweigh the benefits, and if the indication was valid. And that all depends on the medical standards of the day, which would be your guidelines and stuff, right? So the consent form will be pivotal in relation to how the doctor talk to the patient, how he explained everything to the patient. And then one, that's the first part. And then once you do the procedure, whatever, even if something goes wrong, then there'll be the duty to actually determine if there was a breach in the duty of care. Because once there's a breach, then
So, doctor, so if I'm understanding you correctly, then what you are in effect saying...
Yes, please.
That if I'm understanding you correctly, that what you are in effect saying is that the consent form really don't exonerate you from a charge of malpractice, but just to say yes, I gave permission to do this procedure. Am I correct?
Right. The duty of the consent is to make sure that you understand what I'm doing. You understand? And they have to make sure that you're fully informed of the complications, the risks, the benefits, etc.
Yeah.
Now, as it's a human thing, things can happen. The issue is that if something happens, was the doctor or whoever, was there a breach? Because people just say this doctor was negligent, but to prove negligence is not an easy thing. You have to determine if there was a breach, right? But I don't get into that because that's a lawyer.
You're not a lawyer.
All I can tell you is that if I doing something, my standard would be to the UK standard, and I would do everything in terms of the consent forms and stuff. So when I'm talking to you in Barbados, it would be the same way how I'd be talking to you if you were in front of me, if I was as a consultant in
but
the UK, which I am. So in terms of the consent,
let me just say this and move on. I have no doubt, absolutely
yes,
no
please.
Doubt, that patients in this country get the best possible medical care. I have no doubt about that.
But yes, please.
But I just want to say that my concern was about the word exonerate. You know, that's why I brought the word in.
No, I never said exonerated. No, you don't say exonerate.
And who said it, not you?
Yes, please.
I was just trying to find out if I haven't signed, after having signed the consent form, if that would exonerate doctor from malpractice. That's all.
No, the answer to that is no. But in terms of good practice, if you consent the patient, well, give them all the information.
Yeah.
Once they're signed, then they're actually agreeing to the procedure. And that is for that part, because they got different parts that you got to look at.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you kindly,
no
sir.
No problem. Have a good night, sir.
And and Dr. Boyce will contact you, I'm quite sure, very soon.
Yes. Yes, Greatston, I will.
Yes.
So we were just about to jump into quickly how to check for your IUD, and then we're going to move on.
Right. So essentially what you do a week or well after, you can wait until the patient's period has passed. And usually this is the time whereby the womb actually gets rid of the actual coil, right? So you check like a week after the period to see if the coil, the treads are there, right? If you pass the speculum and you don't see the treads, then you're mandatory to do an ultrasound scan to make sure that it is inside the womb, right? The problem will come if you don't see the treads and you do the scan and there's nothing in the womb, then you're mandatory have to do a plain abdominal x-ray to see if the coil is present. If the coil is present on the x-ray, it means that it's not in the uterus. So you have to go for it. So you have to do laparoscopic surgery to have a look inside and see it. All right? But that in itself is rare. I've only seen about 2 cases of that in 20 years. So that in itself is rare.
The most common cause for not finding the strings is actually expulsion of the...
Of the coil itself.
IUD, Most common. Oops. So...
And some women actually just expel them like that. That is in the minority, but it can happen.
All right, let's talk about, and we might be breaching law here again. Let's talk about female sterilization. How are tubes tied? Because I know that in the minds of some people, they think that the tubes are actually, you know, like how you tie a lacing.
Yes, please. Oh, okay. No.
Uh-huh. Yes. Okay. Howard tube stayed.
Right. Now, they got two ways, either open or laparoscopic. If the most common time to tie the tubes in an open operation is at cesarean section. So usually after 3 or 4 cesareans, then most women will opt to get the tubes tied. And the technique that this is called is a modified Primrose technique. And I've never seen anybody got pregnant after this. Essentially, what we do is the tube is like a cylinder. So what you do is pull the middle of the tube up, yes, to make like a U. That would be a U.
Or an N.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I don't know my alphabet. So you pull it up, and then once you pull it up, the two parts of the lower bit, they have the top of the end. So the lower part of the end is where you actually make a tie around there. So you actually have a long piece of tissue, at least more than 2 centimeters. And then what we do is cut above the suture. So essentially what we do is remove at least 1/3 to 2/3 of the actual tube. And this is what stops you from getting pregnant. You have a 1 in 250 chance in 10 years of getting pregnant after sterilization. And if you get pregnant, then it's very unusual for you to get an intrauterine pregnancy, but you're at high risk to getting an ectopic pregnancy. Yeah. So that's the open technique. About 15 years ago, I don't really see it much. You get what we call a postnatal tubal ligation. And essentially, the womb is outside of the pelvis, like up by the, just below the umbilicus. So what you used to do is to make a small incision below the umbilicus and then just take
that's the tube your navel in case, you know, navel.
Yes. So that's the open technique. But mainly it's laparoscopic. So what we do is you have what we call a Fauci clip. So once you do keyhole surgery, what we do is we then clip both of your tubes. Yeah. Depending on where you are, sometimes some people will advocate removing the whole tube. And that's called a salpingectomy. But that's not commonly done, but it can be done in relation to removing the whole tube. And then essentially that's the process of the tubal ligation.
Okay, another common common problem, and this is where you get into the whole legal aspect. I'm going to broach this topic just very briefly. Many people, I shouldn't say many, quite a few persons have said, I have 4 children already. I might be 22. But I have 4 children and I don't want any more children. Why can I not have my tube stayed?
Right. No, I know exactly where you're coming from. And this is my professional. Well, you can't have a professional person.
Okay, hold on. Wait. The following information is the opinion of the speaker. And yes, not the opinion of VOB or any of the other studios at Starcom Network.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Okay. You have a lady at 22 who has 4 children. More than likely, in relation to socioeconomic status, she might not be able to take care of these children adequately, right? And that is not a prejudicial statement.
Yeah, already, understood.
Yeah, because she's 22. Now, sometimes if these people are in front of you, it's hard pressed to tell these people no, because she has 4 children young, and she might not have 4, she might have 3, but her mind is made up. She don't want any more children. So the question to you as a clinician is that, do you want to do this procedure or not? Most people would say no, because she's young, she might want more children and stuff. But on the flip side, if a highly educated lady at 26 with 2 children comes and says she wants tubal ligation, more likely you will do it, because you're thinking, well, she knows exactly what she wants. So there's a catch 22. For in terms of personally, I would think, well, this lady more likely has a mind made up. And not necessarily 22, because 22 is quite young, but over 25, 30, and they want a tubal ligation to complete the family. That's all they want, because in this day and age, to have 4 or 5 children, that is a lot to take on, to be honest, right?
And it is.
You have to look at the individual to see. If you know that they're immature and they know what they want, then fine. On the other hand, if you don't think that the surgery is the best thing for them, then you have to say, well, the next alternative that is as good as a tubal ligation would be the marina cord, which is the IUD, because that is just as good as tubal ligation. So you have to counsel them, because at the end of the day, you can't just say, well, you can do tie your tubes if you don't tell them about the alternatives to
to
these things. So the Mirena, the copper T is a long-acting reversible contraception that you can keep in for 5 to 10 years. So you have to tell them about these. Now, some women will come in the mind made up, but you have to tell them, well, you have your long-acting, which is your Mirena, your copper coil, and you have to give them the differences in the failure rate and stuff, and then decide if the tubal ligation is the best to them. But I can see where you're coming from, because if the woman is highly educated and she only has 2 children and she wants to tie off, more than likely she will get it. On the other hand, if you have somebody who's not as well off and have 4 children, then they may or may not get it. And that's across the board. It's not just here, it's all over the world.
Right. And please, please, listeners, do not let it be said that Dr. John Barker said that a 22-year-old woman with 4 children is not able to take care of her 4 children.
No.
It was just an example, and we just want to make sure that the air is clear. Let's do one more gynecological procedure, and we'll get into some obstetrics. Let's talk about colposcopy, because here in Barbados, you know, the term is very, very common, colposcopy, but many people don't really understand what colposcopy is. So
let's
take this call first, and then we'll deal with colposcopy. Good evening. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Season's greetings to each and every one of you. Peace
be on to
every one of you also, and to the listeners. Doc, I love this program this evening, and Mr. Barker?
Dr. John Barker.
Right. Mr. Barker, you sound like 16. You sound like you were doing, you were serving this country for 20 years. And there's something that I love what you said, and you're a man of my heart. If an educated person comes in and asks to have, because it happened, and they have proved on many people, even some of my family too, who went to ask and they were refused. And there's a lot of people out there, young or old, who have children that they want any more children but was refused from getting surgery. And that, I love what you say, and you're totally right. Have a wonderful evening, and I always do enjoy.
Thanks a lot, my dear. You as well.
Yeah, have a lot of educators. And I want to thank Dr. Boyce for doing this job. May God continue to wish the best to you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good evening too. All right, Dr. Barker, so we were about to jump into colposcopy, and just for Gail, this is just a little tidbit. Dr. Barker is now beginning to show a few signs of age. His face belies his age. He does not look as though he's been practicing. It's only now that he's getting a little gray. But nah, Dr. Barker looks young. So let's talk about colposcopy.
Yeah. Essentially, what is colposcopy? Colposcopy is a procedure whereby you use a low-powered microscope to look at the neck of the womb, right? And by low-powered, what we mean is that it's like a microscope, and then you have a bright light that looks at the neck of the womb. We would put something equivalent to like vinegar on the neck of the womb, which is called acetic acid. And then what that does is to show up the abnormal cells. So the more abnormal the cells are, they show up white. So the whiter they are, yeah? And then once, depending on the pattern, then we would take a biopsy. Now, in relation to the indications for the colposcopy, you will have to have an abnormal smear. Yeah. So either a smear that is a low grade smear, and you have low, moderate, and severe. Yeah. We call it dyscariosis. Or sometimes you can have cells which we don't know where they're coming from. So what we do then will be an HPV test to see if it's negative or positive. So if you have a positive HPV test and this and and the cells are what we call like squamous cells are on determined significance, meaning that we don't know where they're coming from, then you would be a candidate for colposcopy. Or if on the smear shows that there is an indication for it to have cervical cancer or endometrial cancer. So that's when we would do the colposcopy. Now, the colposcopy in itself is a short procedure, maybe about 10, 15 minutes. That's to do the biopsy. If you have a severe abnormality, a moderate to severe abnormality or cancer, then you may have to get what you call a LETS, which is a large loop excision in the transformation zone, which is done under local anesthetic in the office or as an outpatient. And this is essentially to remove the abnormal cells, because before you get to cancer, you have to realize that you have at least 10 to 20 years before it can change, unless you have a very aggressive form. But essentially, the benefit of the colposcopy is to remove these abnormal cells, because you have to remember that the main stay for the colposcopy is to prevent cervical cancer. And cervical cancer usually has a long dormant phase in relation to the precancerous lesions. All right?